Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. Delighted you could join us today. My guest this week is Dave Wasserman, who is an editor at the Cook Political Report and an expert on the House of Representatives and redistricting, which is highly relevant at this moment. So, Dave, thank you so much. Appreciate your being here.
Thanks for having me, Mona. It's an honor.
Earlier this month, you had a piece at the Cook Political Report comparing the 2018 moment and political environment to 2026. And I found it very interesting. I want to get into it because there's been a lot of talk lately. I hear it all the time where people are just saying, well, there's going to be a huge blue wave in 2026. And it's just assumed that that's going to happen because of the election results in 2025, which were quite dramatic, and because there's so much dissatisfaction with Trump, and frankly, because some people are, myself included, very much hoping for that outcome. But it may not be quite so simple this time. And you spelled it out. So 2018, Democrats picked up 41 seats. Do you, let's overall picture, big view, do you think that's a realistic ambition in 2026? Something like that number?
No, it's not, because Democrats are starting out from a much higher floor than they did in 2018. So Democrats are effectively at 215 House seats, which means they only need 3 to get the majority. They started out at 194 in 2018. And so, a 20-seat gain would get Democrats to the same outcome in terms of seats that the 41-seat gain got them in 2018. But I think 20 is even ambitious for Democrats this year because the number of competitive seats has fallen over time, both due to the self-sorting of the American electorate along urban versus rural lines, but even within suburban areas. And then the gerrymandering that has erupted into a national war between the parties this year. So the total number of competitive seats is a bit lower. And I also think another factor is that there are fewer split ticket voters than there used to be, fewer people who are willing to split their tickets between a Senate and a House race, or who they voted for president last time, and a House race. What we are seeing is a lot of reversion among independents and Latino voters versus how they voted in 2024. And on the surface, President Trump's approval rating is similar to where it was at this point during his first term, maybe a tick higher just because he has stronger support within his base. But the big difference is inflation. And voters rehired President Trump in 2024 to lower prices and turn around the economy and usher in the golden age that he promised. They're not seeing that. And whereas in his first term, his approval rating when it came to handling the economy was consistently about 3 points higher than his overall approval, this year it's been consistently about 3 points lower. And that is fundamentally driving voter attitudes. And at the same time, Democrats' energy level and outrage level is as high or higher than it was 8 years ago.
Yeah, we'll get to that, too, because you've got a whole very well-organized list here. And I want to touch on all of the points that you made. But first, I want to circle back to the point you made a minute ago about the self-sorting. Maybe you can clear this up for me, because I want to understand it. I understand that people are tending to live in places now where their neighbors think the way they do, and that people are choosing where to live based on that in part. But if we're comparing 2018 with 2026, I mean, it hasn't been that long. From what I gather, people aren't moving as often as they used to. So it can't be that between 2018 and 2026, a whole bunch of people said, you know what? I don't like it here in Manhattan. I'm moving to Boise, you know, and there can't have been that much. And so what I'm wondering is it a physical move or a mental move that we're talking about?
Keep in mind, we had a pandemic in between these two midterms that we're talking about.
Yeah.
And so there were a number of people who moved for family or job related reasons during the pandemic. And I think what we're seeing that's new, we've seen self-sorting happen for the last 5 or 6 decades where people are choosing to live near others who share their political and cultural values. We've seen a clustering, a geographic clustering of Americans who have earned college degrees in certain elite suburbs and urban areas. What's different, though, is state-based sorting. And now that that states and their governors are signaling whether they are for or against Donald Trump, it is a beacon for voters as to whether they are welcome, whether their politics are welcome in a certain state. And that is accelerating the rate at which states are moving left or right. I think that the two biggest variables remaining in redistricting, which we'll get to, are Florida and Virginia. But it's instructive that in Florida, Governor DeSantis's policies, particularly during COVID, sent the signal to voters who didn't want to be constrained by blue state governors' public health directives that they were more welcome in Florida. And mm-hmm. in Virginia, we've seen Democrats who are in control in Richmond decry cuts to the federal workforce and uphold pro-choice state laws. And that has made it a welcome state for left-leaning voters. And so they're continuing to move in opposite directions.
Regarding your comments about the economy and people's disenchantment with Trump about the state of the economy and his approval rating having dropped on his management of the economy, which was always a strength for him, and now it's a weakness. In terms of people's voting behavior, how important is the economy versus other issues?
It is the key driver of what happens in our elections these days because inflation is such an overriding concern. Gallup has found that the percentage of voters that rank the economy as their top voting issue has tripled since 8 years ago. And particularly when we're in an inflationary environment, the party in power is held responsible, even though there's very little a White House of either party can directly do to lower prices. Democrats, of course, are going to hammer tariffs in the midterms, although the main focus will be healthcare as it relates to affordability. But one thing we did in 2024 at the Cook Political Report, we surveyed 3,000 voters in a kind of a time series, an online survey that we did in conjunction with one Democratic and one Republican pollster. And what I wanted to do was figure out who the 7% of people who are either completely undecided or not firmly committed to Harris or Trump, who they were and what they cared about. What we found was that they were even more diverse than the rest of the electorate. They skewed female and they skewed younger, which in theory ought to have given Democrats and Harris more upside because they traditionally do well with those groups. But they cared about the economy even more than those partisans who are firmly decided. They cared mm-hmm. less about abortion and immigration, which makes some sense. These were pocketbook voters who were asking themselves, am I better or worse off than I was 4 years ago? And even though they deeply disliked both nominees, by 55 to 26 margin, they trusted Trump more than Harris to turn the economy around. Those are the voters who have reversed on Trump. And in particular, we saw the biggest swings in heavily Latino areas and immigrant communities in New Jersey, Virginia, and other off-year elections in 2025.
In your piece, which I have to say was unbelievably well organized, good job. First, you listed the dissimilarities between 2018 and 2026, and then you went to the similarities. Let's flip it. Let's start with the similarities. And the first one you mentioned was Democrats are centering their message on healthcare.
That's right. I should have flipped it, Mona. Sorry about that. But in 2018, pre-existing conditions were at the center of Democrats' message. And the irony is that repeal and replace didn't even succeed. It didn't pass. Remember John McCain's thumbs down?
Yes.
But Democrats ran a blistering barrage of ads on it anyway, and it ended up costing Republicans 41 seats. This time around, the change is real. You know, I'd argue, you know, the in 2017 and 2018, the shock and awe was Trump's election itself. It was a huge surprise. It was an upset. We had the Women's March and then a huge fight at town halls over healthcare and repeal and replace. And even Republicans who did not sign on, many of them got penalized. This time around, the changes are vast and they're real. In addition to the Medicaid overhaul and funding cuts in the One Big Beautiful Bill, the White House has done very little to give cover to Republicans who want to forge a bipartisan deal on enhanced ACA subsidies. And in fact, it has shown little interest in addressing the Obamacare cliff, even after a discharge petition was successful. So Democrats are going to be running on soaring premiums. They're going to be running on the changes that the CBO estimates will cost 11 million Americans who are enrolled under marketplace plans coverage in the next 10 years. These ads pretty much write themselves, and it connects to affordability. And so a number of Republicans are starting to put more distance between themselves and the White House.
And we've already seen enrollments drop in Obamacare plans because of the huge premium increases. So people are already losing their healthcare coverage.
That's right. And a number of people who are covered under those plans are trying to manipulate their income so that it's below a certain level to avoid
qualifying.
This huge spike. So
right.
That becomes a fairness and competence issue for the party in charge. Can they at least come to a compromise that prevents those people who are caught on the edge of that cliff?
So 2018, Republicans were punished not for changing healthcare, but for attempting to. And voters were not happy about that, even though they didn't succeed in changing it. This time, there really is, I'm summarizing, obviously, your points. This time, there really has been a change. People are feeling it, and it ties into the whole question of affordability, which is sort of the overarching argument Democrats are making.
Right. And this isn't anything new or specific to Republicans, because in virtually every midterm since 1994, the party in power has gotten penalized for attempting a major healthcare overhaul or how that overhaul has been implemented, dating back
right.
to Hillary Care, but then also the passage of Obamacare and then 2010.
Yep.
And the rollout of the ACA website in 2014. So this is as old as time.
It really is. Okay. Democrats' enthusiasm advantage. Talk about that if you would.
Yeah, this is really the hallmark politically of the Trump era. It used to be that when more people voted, Democrats did better. Back when Obama was around, he ushered in millions of new participants to the process who came out and voted for him. But they didn't show up and vote in midterms like 2010 and 2014, and Democrats got clobbered in those years. Now it's running the opposite direction, and I think it's an even more dramatic turnout differential, where President Trump has gotten the bulk of his support from people who don't eat, sleep, and breathe politics. He is exceptional as an outsider political figure when it comes to appealing to people who don't tune in to traditional political news, and whether it is appearing at UFC fights or sneaker con or F1 races, he is going to places where you wouldn't normally expect to find a politician show up. Democrats are excelling with the voters who don't just show up in presidentials, but every midterm, primary, race for school board, dog catcher, special elections. And so when turnout goes down, Democrats have a structural advantage. I think this is one of the reasons why Democrats fared a little bit better than expectations in 2022. They lost the House, but not as nearly as many seats as some expected. And in 2026, we're seeing this the same dynamic that we saw 8 years ago, where Democrats are hyper motivated in special elections. And, you know, even in larger turnout races like Virginia and New Jersey's gubernatorial election, the Democrats in those races garnered about 81-83% of the Harris vote total. The Republicans garnered 69-71% of the Trump total. And if you were to superimpose that on every race in the country, Democrats would easily take back the House and be right on the cusp of taking back the Senate. The reason I think it's not that easy for Democrats is that turnout is going to be higher than these specials and off-year elections. It's going to be lower than 2024, obviously, but that middle turnout level, you know, probably makes Democrats underdogs in the Senate, but keeps them favorites in the House.
Okay. The next item on your list is Democrats' choice of national security candidates. Again, this is something that they did in 2018. So if you would.
Yeah, we're seeing Democrats go back to a playbook that proved successful for them. And many of those Democrats who were elected to the House in 2018 have gone on to bigger things. Abigail Spanberger, Mikey Sherrill, Alyssa Slotkin, a number of them are still in the House. This time, Democrats are relying on candidates like Joe Mendoza in Arizona's 6th District, a retired Marine, a former Navy helicopter pilot, Rebecca Bennett, running in New Jersey's 7th District, Kate Conley, who's an Army officer. She has to get through a primary in New York 17, but she would be a strong contender against Mike Lawler, who's one of Republicans' most talented incumbents.
And a moderate. They're always the first to go, of course.
Yeah. And so that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg. And there are plenty of Democrats who are running with more traditional political backgrounds as well, whether it's State Senator Sean McCann in Michigan 4 or the mayor of Scranton, Paige Kennedy, running against Rob Bresnahan in Pennsylvania 8. But it makes sense that Democrats are leaning into this national security profile, given that it's harder for Republicans to attack someone who has served in the military, and it's harder in general for either party to attack an opponent who lacks a political record.
So they get the credit and the credential of having served in the military and being serious about national defense. Plus, they don't have a whole long list of votes that they can make ads about. So
right, and in the current context, when the president's decisions as commander in chief are coming under scrutiny, whether it is military action in Venezuela or the decision to investigate Democratic senators who made a video objecting to the president, it helps Democrats to field candidates who have credibility from having worn the uniform.
Absolutely.
Running against Republicans who are tough to beat.
Mm-hmm. Just out of curiosity, is New Jersey's 7th district, is that a swing district or what kind of a district is it?
It's actually my home district, but
I'm Kane from New Jersey Jr. also.
Yeah. this is north central New Jersey. It's a district that actually got redder in the last round of redistricting because the Democrats kind of cut this deal to shore up some of their other seats. But also create a stronger opportunity for Republican Tom Kaine Jr. in this seat. So he won by single digits last time around. This is near the top of Democrats' target list.
Oh, okay. Interesting. All right. Number four, no clear Democratic leader. What do you mean by that?
The Democrats' brand is in worse shape than it was 8 years ago. And right now, according to the latest NBC News poll, only 26% of voters have a favorable view of the Democratic Party. And that's primarily because even Democrats don't like the Democratic Party. People on that side are frustrated with their leader's inability to effectively counter what's coming from the White House and the expansion of executive power. There's very little that Hakeem Jeffries or Chuck Schumer can do about it, but they haven't been seen as effective even after the longest government shutdown that we've had. And so Democrats don't have one clear identity or leader. I think the split screen from November was Zoran Mamdani in New York City versus Spanberger and Sherrill, who won these big governor's races. And I'd say the slight majority of the party is still in the center left, particularly the minority constituents of the Democratic Party who are a little bit more more moderate on many cultural issues than the party overall. But there is a robust effort on the progressive left to field candidates in even competitive districts and states this time around. I think the marquee primary for Democrats will be in Maine between Governor Janet Mills and Graham Platner, Bernie Sanders endorsed oyster farmer. And so it's
that. Wait, can I just ask a question about that race? I just came across something this morning. It said that Graham Platner was taking a break because he and his wife are pursuing IVF. So he's not campaigning. Does that mean he's pulling out? Do you have any insight into that?
The Platner family has highlighted the unaffordability of IVF in the U.S. as a reason why they are seeking treatment abroad. I don't believe he's suspending his campaign so much as taking a personal break.
How can he afford it abroad? I don't get it. When you go abroad, you don't qualify for their publicly funded health insurance. If you go to Canada, believe me, I know this from personal experience, and you need to see a doctor, you have to pay cash on the barrelhead. We Americans traveling in Canada help to keep their system going. So I don't understand this. Where's he going? He went to Norway or something to do IVF? How's that going to get paid for? This is a tangent. I'm sorry. I just found it a weird thing.
But in some cases, candidates seek to tie their own personal financial circumstance or a healthcare episode or event in their lives to as a means of connecting with voters. And in this case, I think it's possible it could be effective. Platner has certainly been the recipient of a lot of negative headlines as a result of Democrats allied with Mills dropping opposition research to try to bring his campaign and his polling numbers back down to earth. So this could be a helpful change of subject.
Well, Janet Mills would be a perfect candidate if she were 20 years younger. It's a, you know, it's a shame that she would be 80 or something when she took the oath or something like that.
I believe she'd be 78 or 79.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Oldest freshman senator in history.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it could be okay, but anyway, it's a little worrisome. All right. Finally, the, to pursue this for another minute, because I wasn't quite sure what you meant by this. So there's no clear Democratic leader. How does that play? I mean, some people say, look, it's better if there's no clear Democratic figure that can be demonized, like the Republicans demonized Nancy Pelosi as a symbol of the party. And they've done that with AOC. Could they do that with Mamdani in 26? Could they make him, assuming that Mamdani does left-wing stuff in New York, as he has promised to do, that they could make him the face of the party? Or so are you saying it's a benefit or a detriment to not have a leader?
I agree that it's a benefit that Democrats don't have one figurehead to attack. And I think even Republicans are divided on which Democrats to make the boogeyman in this campaign. Some would like to keep the focus on Mamdani, but the president has made that harder. He had a very chummy meeting with Zoran Mamdani in the Oval Office.
They're texting pals, apparently.
Right. Some Republicans would like to continue running against Joe Biden. Some Republicans would like to make 2026 more about Tim Walz the investigations into social services fraud in Minnesota to try and highlight how a progressive experiment has become entangled in mismanagement. So Republicans are going to have to find ways to individually disqualify Democrats in these races, because even though the Democrats' brand is poor, midterms are fundamentally a referendum on the president and the party in power, unless that party gives voters a valid reason not to vote for an alternative in a state or district.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Finally, the Senate map, it insulates Republicans. So that was true in 2018. It's true in 2026. What is your evaluation of the Senate right now, speaking in January? Is there a chance that it could flip, or how is it looking?
Well, there's certainly a chance, but it's a small chance because Democrats would effectively need to run the table on all of the races that are in the central part of the battleground. There are really only four truly purple states that are up for election in the Senate this year, and those are Maine, Michigan, North Carolina, and Georgia. And Democrats are defending two of those seats. They're defending Georgia and Michigan. And so even if Democrats were to sweep all four of those, that would only get them to 49 Senate seats, and they would need to win two more to get to 51 and win control. That forces Democrats to win at least two of their four reach states, and those reach states would be Iowa, Ohio, Alaska, and Texas. All four of those states voted for Trump by at least 11 points. Ohio was the smallest margin at 11. And Alaska and Iowa were 13. Texas was 14. So these are very difficult states for Democrats to win, especially given that even in these special elections where Democrats have been overperforming, they've done so typically by about 8 to 13 points. And so Mary Peltola's entry in Alaska gives Democrats some hope there. But even as strong a candidate as she is, she's only ever beaten one Republican in Alaska, and that's Sarah Palin, who had a 61% unfavorability rating. And that was with a boost from Republican disunity amid ranked choice voting. So I think that's a very tough state for Democrats to win.
Is that an open seat, or is she running against an incumbent?
She's running against Senator Dan Sullivan. And so this is Republican incumbent who's not nearly as vulnerable or weak as Palin was. And so then you get to Iowa, and Republicans' chances probably got better when Joni Ernst got out of the race and Ashley Hinson is their nominee. Democrats have a competitive primary there. And then Sherrod Brown in Ohio arguably has the best chance of winning of these four states for Democrats. But he has to run against a fairly mainstream Republican, John Husted, who doesn't have as many vulnerabilities as Bernie Moreno did, even after Moreno beat Brown by 5 points in 24.
One of the compromises at the Constitutional Convention that didn't work out too well was giving every state the same number of senators. But that's what we've got. Let's go on to the list that you made of dissimilarities from 2018. The first one you list is inflation and geopolitical uncertainty. I don't think we need to spend any time on inflation. I think everybody understands its importance. And we spoke earlier about, you know, how important the economy is to people's voting. And if inflation is what they think about when they think about the economy, the prices are too damn high. But what about geopolitical uncertainty? We always hear that people don't vote on foreign policy, usually, but why don't we examine that a little bit?
When you go back over the last 30 to 40 years of midterms, it's, you know, there are only two that really stand out as having been heavily impacted by foreign policy. And that would be 2002, when George W. Bush was able to buck the trend of the party in power losing seats because there was a rally around the flag effect after 9/11. And then in 2006, when Bush paid the price politically for an unpopular war in Iraq, and the specter of U.S. intervention in a variety of places in 2026, whether it is Venezuela, Greenland, Iraq.
Greenland.
These, when voters are polled on whether they are open to U.S. military intervention in these places, it's pretty deeply underwater. And even though opinions on the capture of Maduro were pretty even, when it comes to spending military defense budget and military intervention in parts of the world that are cauldrons, voters are very skeptical and they become very leery of the president's approach or his interpretation of America First. I still don't think it's on track to become as salient an issue for voters as the economy and inflation, but it does add to some downside risk, or at least the narrative that the president is not making good on his campaign promises from 2024 of peace and prosperity. And his approval when it comes to foreign policy has been right around his overall approval. It's been in low 40s for some time because of the inability to broker any deal between Russia and Ukraine. This only adds to those problems. And he did not really get much of a boost from the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas.
Also, and this is, I guess, you know, really impossible to poll accurately, but, you know, people's view of foreign interventions might also be affected by their sense of the motive. You know, if the idea is to restore democracy and free the Venezuelan people, that's one thing. If the point is to give your buddies in the oil business a windfall and not really materially change the government at all in Venezuela, that's a different thing. And regarding Greenland, I mean, there's absolutely positively no constituency for doing this. And the obvious motive is aggrandizement for Donald Trump himself. There's no reason to do this. And it would blow up NATO. I mean, it's unbelievable that we're even talking about it. But anyway, that may play into it.
Yeah, just looking at the latest Economist YouGov poll, which was one of the only pieces of polling data taken since the dust has settled from that extraction of Maduro, voters, a large survey of voters were asked what they believed the U.S. motivation was in that operation, and 62% believed that it had to do with the U.S. Prioritizing access to oil. There were kind of mid-30s responses to combating narco-terrorism and fighting the drug trade. But then when it came to the notion of installing or furthering democracy in the region, only 12% of voters believed that the operation had a lot to do with that. So yeah, that says it all.
Yeah, it sure does. Okay, another difference is that from 2018, there's been a redistricting war. So when Trump first started pressuring Republican state legislatures to redistrict, it looked like they might be able to get away with this. But how is it looking now?
The White House, when they launched this redistricting war in Texas, they believed that they could gain somewhere in the mid single digit to maybe 10 seat range by pressuring red states to redraw their boundaries. And there was ample reason back then to believe that they could, given that there were state constitutional constraints in blue states on redrawing boundaries in a partisan way or in the middle of the decade. And Republicans had a free hand in Texas and other states, including Indiana, Missouri, Kansas, to be able to redraw lines. And there was certainly more upside if both parties were given the opportunity to maximize the map in their favor in states that they control. Republicans simply had more juice to squeeze. What's happened, though, it was not along the plan that Republicans had in mind. Gavin Newsom in California spearheaded an effort to amend the state constitution and pass a map that I would argue has more upside for Democrats than the Texas map has for Republicans. Keep in mind that in Texas, the map that Greg Abbott signed into law, it includes three districts that are pretty easy flips, but two seats were made just slightly redder in the Rio Grande Valley. And those are the seats held by Vicente Gonzalez and Henry Cuellar. Trump pardoned Henry Cuellar, who was under investigation. And Cuellar is the favorite to win another term in that seat. So two of those five Democratic target seats could remain in Democrats' column, whereas I think Democrats are on track to pick up at least four seats in California. Now, the biggest remaining variables after Republicans rejected Trump's bid to redraw lines in Indiana, although Republicans were successful in North Carolina and Missouri pending a ballot petition fight. But the two biggest remaining variables are Virginia and Florida. Democrats are going to be asking voters in Virginia to amend the state constitution to let the legislature approve new lines. They could target three or four Republicans. We've heard rumors of some truly audacious plans in Florida being considered by Governor DeSantis. He wants to push the process to April to minimize the time frame for any kind of legal challenge to a new map, but that could eliminate at least three Democratic seats. So those two states could offset. And then the Supreme Court decision on the Voting Rights Act. If the VRA Section 2 is struck down, that could allow Louisiana to dismantle both Democratic districts in that state. But at the end of the day, this is not the windfall for Republicans they were expecting at the outset. We could have anything from a from very little net change to maybe a 2 or 3 seat gain for Republicans from new maps. And that certainly does not put the House out of reach for Democrats.
And the Voting Rights Act decision could come as late as June, which might not leave enough time for redistricting before 2026, right? That would only leave a few months.
Louisiana Republicans have sought to push back the election calendar to leave time to redraw its maps. If a decision comes down that falls in their favor. But I think it would be too late for the other states where black majority districts could be targeted or dismantled. I'm not speaking hyperbolically when I say that striking down Section 2 of the VRA would be an apocalyptic development for black representation in the South. And you could see the progress that that voters of color made in the 80s and 90s basically being entirely washed away by a ruling that would strike down Section 2. I'm still not convinced that's the direction that the court will take. But if it does, that would have enormous ramifications for 2028 and almost guarantee that Republicans could take would take back the majority in the House in 28 if they lose it in 26.
A lot riding on that. All right. So the third dissimilarity that you cited, and we've touched on this a little bit, but you say this time there are more open seats but fewer takeover opportunities. So just briefly spell that out again, if you would.
Yeah, that's right. We're at a historic level of retirements and exits from the House. And actually, the majority of these open seats are not attributable to pure retirements, but rather runs for other office. And some have to do with redistricting. Some are moderate members who are really sick of having to put up with the constraints of their own base. Don Bacon from Omaha, Nebraska, Jared Golden from Maine. I can't help but think that that members' personal sense of personal security in this political climate can play a role, particularly those members with young families. And then there's also the fact that Republicans, many in the House, feel like they have accomplished most of what they reasonably can accomplish with the passage of the reconciliation bill, and that very little is likely to happen legislatively in the next 2 years. So I think that's driving some of it as well. Certainly 38 gubernatorial offices being up for election in 2026 prompted a number of members to leave to run for governor. So we're on a historic pace. But very few of these seats are truly vulnerable to takeover by the other party, because most of the members who would be vulnerable, well, they've already been weeded out by losses and retirements in past years.
Democrats, Brad, weaker this time than it was in 2018. But does that really matter when a midterm is always about the performance of the party in power in the White House?
I think what it does mean is that a number of Democrats are going to have to illustrate independence from their own party in addition to running against Donald Trump. And that might be a bit more of an emphasis than in the past.
Mm-hmm. What aspects of their party? Distancing themselves from Biden, from the immigration mess, from what?
I think it depends on the district. And in some districts that marginally voted for Trump in 2024, you're going to hear from Democrats who want to strike a middle ground, where they put distance between themselves and Democrats are calling for the abolition of ICE, but also calling for investigations that involve state prosecutors and investigatory bodies in addition to the Department of Justice, and calling out the administration for the most unpopular aspects of the reconciliation bill without embracing a single payer healthcare plan. And I think you'll also in general see a lot of Democrats who don't emphasize that they are a Democrat and point to other aspects of their biography to try and validate their qualifications with voters.
Arguably, the whole immigration question has been inverted because of the conduct of ICE and what the president is now doing with these shock troops, you know, not only abusing immigrants, but even American citizens. Abolish ICE may be a step too far, but I mean, dramatic reform, scaling back, oversight. I don't know. I mean, that doesn't seem to me in the environment that we're in now to be of, you know, excessively left-wing position by any stretch. What do you think?
Well, look, no poll is perfect, but the Economist YouGov poll from this week found, and this is the first time I've ever seen this, a plurality of voters supporting abolishing ICE. Now, I think you're going to see some on the left, and that was 46-43. I think you are going to see a litmus test in many Democratic primaries, including for 2028, on this question of whether ICE should be replaced in addition to reform. I know, you know, this was a focal point of autopsies after losses in recent years for Democratic candidates, but it's taken on a new paradigm, a new significance in the wake of Renee Good. And a majority of voters still favor deporting immigrants who are in the country illegally to their home countries. The New York Times Siena poll found in October that voters favor that by 54-43. At the same time, polls are routinely telling us that voters disapprove of the tactics that ICE is using to round up and deport illegal immigrants. And it's running underwater by about 15 to 20 points. So the key group of voters up for grabs this November are going to be the voters who believe that illegal immigrants should be deported, but disapprove of the tactics that ICE is using. And the candidates who speak to those voters in the way that resonates with them will have the best chance of winning.
It's not just that I think this issue, sorry, I'm a little bit emotional about this. This issue has gone beyond a matter of the best way to deal with illegal immigration. Okay. Because of what ICE has become, this masked, you know, army of goons who are not just rounding up the wrong people like non-criminals and deporting them. That's bad enough. And sometimes deporting them to gulags in other countries. That's all horrific. But now, in the wake of this killing of Renee Good and others, and other horrible acts by ICE, what we have is a complete assault on American civil liberties. They are attacking protesters. They are attacking people who are just standing there with whistles trying to protest what they're doing. And so I have this sense, and tell me if you agree, that like the moment we're in right now is just the whole issue has gone off on a different track, and it's become something that it wasn't 2 weeks ago, and that the polling that we're looking at doesn't reflect that change yet. What do you think?
That could be. And look, the right track, wrong direction numbers have been, pretty wide gulf for some time. I think the average has been, you know, about 30 right direction, 65 wrong track. I'm curious to see whether those numbers increase in the weeks to come, at least the wrong track number. And the anxiety on voters' part is that things are unraveling, that this level of political disunity, but more than that, a disunity over what the basic facts are in any of these tragedies.
Yeah, that's right. That's a part I didn't even mention. That's a good point. You know, immediately blaming the victim and trying to disparage and trying to prosecute her widow.
That is, I think, what's forcing a number of Republican senators, and not just the usual suspects, but like Lisa Murkowski or Susan Collins or Mitch McConnell, but other Republican senators to break from from Trump on several issues. And I suspect you were going to have a level of unease among Senate Republicans that aligns with what we're seeing on the votes on war powers, the votes we've seen in the House on breaking with the White House on extending ACA subsidies. I think there's a growing sense in Congress that things are spiraling out of control and that there needs to be greater leadership and greater conciliation, that they can't rely on it from the president. So it's going to have to come from others in the party.
Okay. Final thing that you mentioned is that the Democrats had a big fundraising advantage in 2018 that they don't necessarily have this year.
That's right. And the money picture is quite different. In 2018, Democrats were outraising Republican incumbents left and right. Just the energy and passion among the donors was at a historic level. John Ossoff had raised over $40 million for a House special election in Georgia. And Democrats were able to control the narrative in a lot of races, not just in 18, but all the way through 2024 at the candidate level. What you're seeing now, I think, is two things happen. First of all, the president, by virtue of his influence over everything, is receiving more support from the business community. Big businesses who have a real stake in what the executive branch does. That's fed into why MAGA Inc. has $304 million in cash on hand, whereas Democrats don't have a comparable super PAC. Now, it really remains an open question: to what extent is that Trump PAC going to dive into key congressional races, or is it going to preserve a lot of that money for 2028? But at the party committee level, Democrats are not enjoying the same superiority that they enjoyed in 2018. The DNC has about a fifth of the cash on hand as the RNC. There's a looming Supreme Court decision that could basically eliminate the limits on coordination between parties and candidates, which could allow Republicans to funnel money to cash-strapped candidates. Democrats at the candidate level are not seeing the same passion that Democratic donors had in past years. I think part of it could be that Democratic donors are a bit fatigued from fighting Trump. They've given to plenty of long shot Senate candidates over the years who had massive money advantages, but still did not win or come close to winning. And so there's a little bit of disillusionment that may be setting in there, and that that could allow some Republicans to survive.
Okay. So in light of all of this, in light of the nature of the House, how it's changed. There are fewer swing seats, all of the things that we've discussed. What should Democrats realistically think of as a good outcome in 2026? I take it you think 41 seats, that such as they got in 2018, is out of the ballpark. So what is reasonable to hope for?
I think a good outcome for Democrats would be to win the House. And it could be by a slimmer margin than 8 years ago. If you told me that Democrats would end up at 225 seats, I would say that would be a reasonable expectation from today's standpoint, somewhere between 225 and 230. Anything in the mid 230s or above, that would go beyond what we saw in 18, and that would be in territory where Democrats would be competitive for the Senate. I think an exceptional Democratic night obviously would be winning both chambers of Congress, but that is not the likeliest outcome from today's standpoint.
Okay. Well, Dave Wasserman, this has been a great education. I appreciate your input here, and thank you very much.
Thanks, Mona. It's been a pleasure.